Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in veterinary neurology, Louisa D'Arizio. Thank you, Louisa. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Sammy Jo. Good afternoon, everyone. The purpose of this webinar is to revise diagnosis and treatment of spinal anomalies in dogs. Congenital spinal malformations are identified more and more commonly in dogs, and the popularity of certain canine breeds, such as the pug, the French bulldog, have affected how often we encounter these conditions in clinical practice. Congenital spinal malformations may occur at one site or multiple sites along the spine and affect vertebra, spinal cord, or adjacent soft tissues. They may be asymptomatic and be detected as incidental finding when we perform radiography for investigation of thoracic or abdominal diseases, or can result in neurological signs ranging from spinal pain to paralysis and even urinary and fecal incontinence. The challenge for the clinician is to determine whether the spinal malformation is indeed clinically relevant or just an incidental finding. In the veterinary literature, there are some inconsistencies regarding terminology of congenital spinal malformations. Therefore, I have elected to use the terminology presented in a nice review article published in the Small Animal Veterinary Clinic of North America in 2010. In this review article, the authors classify congenital spinal malformation as spinal dysraphism, congenital vertebral anomalies, spinal arachnoid diverticular, and vascular malformations of the spine. The term spinal dysraphism refers to defective closure of the neural tube and includes the overall group of dorsal midline defects derived from the secondary maldevelopment of ectoderm, mesoderm, and near ectoderm layers of tissue, and encompasses a variety of malformations, including spina bifida, dermal sinus tract, meningocele, meningomalocele, and myelosquesis. Congenital vertebral malformations include butterfly vertebra, hemivertebra, also known as wedge vertebra, block vertebra, transitional vertebra, and articular process dysplasia, most commonly presented as hypoplasia or aplasia. These vertebral malformations may occur in isolation or concurrently with spinal cord anomalies, particularly those originating in the embryonic developmental period. Therefore, there is also the challenge to understand whether the neurological signs are the results of the vertebral versus the concurrent spinal cord. Dogs with congenital spinal malformation may have anomalies affecting other regions of the nervous system and other body systems. Therefore, it's very important to perform a thorough assessment of all body systems. In order to identify possible concurrent anomalies, assess their clinical relevance, and prevent any possible complications during general anesthesia. I will now present three different clinical cases affected by various conditions included in the slide where the different types of congenital malformations were outlined. The first case is a six-month-old male pug that was referred with a history of rapidly progressive pelvic limb ataxia and paresis, and we can look at the video now. Here we go. I hope you can see the video well. I like to assess these patients often outdoors, ideally on grass, and allow them to move freely. And that's a great way to assess exactly what they can do. You can see that he's alert, he's looking around, he's quite strong in his thoracic limbs, and he's really struggling to stand up and walk with his pelvic limbs. He's quite clever in trying to lean against the fence, which enables him to have some assistance with balance and move a couple of steps without falling. However, there are obvious significant proprioceptive and motor deficits in both pelvic limbs. And please have a look at the tail. Look at the tail carriage, and then we'll look at it again following treatment. So in summary, the neurological examination of this dog, there was thoracic kyphosis that was obvious on palpation of the spine. You have seen in the video the severe general proprioceptive ataxia in both pelvic limbs and the severe paraparesis. The postural reactions were absent in both pelvic limbs and normal in the thoracic limbs. And a reminder of the neurological assessment was unremarkable. There were no signs of spinal pain. So where would you localize the lesion based on the video and the details of the neurological examination of this dog? Where do you think it could be? Definitely a problem in the spine, and considering that the thoracic limbs were completely normal and the pelvic limbs were greatly abnormal and with normal spinal reflexes, the neuroanatomic localization would be to the thoracolumbar spine. Differential diagnosis. Obviously, this is a webinar on spinal anomalies, so the differential diagnosis will be one of the conditions listed in the slide I showed you earlier about the classification of congenital spinal malformations. And you can try to have a think which of those conditions would fit with the clinical presentation of progressive deterioration of pelvic limb neurological dysfunction in a six-month-old pug. Probably more than one will apply. But generally speaking, obviously, when you are presented with a patient like this one, it would not be a clinical case in a webinar focused on a particular disease group. So I included myelitis in the sense of inflammation of the spinal cord only. If we had meningomyelitis, so inflammation of the meninges and the spinal cord, that would have been pain, because the meninges are highly innervated with nociceptors, whereas the spinal cord itself does not have nociceptor, and that could explain the progressive neurologic dysfunction without any signs of spinal paralgesia. And I leave you a moment to have a think of the conditions outlined in the slide on congenital spinal malformation classification. Where would you think, which one do you think could be the final diagnosis in this pug? We performed hematology serum biochemistry and there were no significant abnormalities. Survey radiography of the thoracic spine and caudal cervical spine is illustrated in this line, and we can see a very obvious marked mid-thoracic kyphosis, and we can see that the Semi-Jo, do you think I could, let me see, I have found the pointer. I was hoping to get the pointer. Yes, thank you very much. I'm trying to point one particular vertebra. Here we go. So you can see that this vertebra, the end plates, are not really parallel. This vertebra seems to have a little bit of a wedgy shape, and we can probably see better in the next slide, which shows the MRI of this pug. So here we see a midline sagittal T2 weighted MRI image of the thoracic spine, and this is a transverse T2 weighted image of taken across the level of T7 vertebra, so across this level, and you can see how severely compressed the spinal cord is. There is no more epidural fat and CSF, and is really flattened dorsoventrally. In the sagittal view, we see that there is the marked mid-thoracic kyphosis, which was obvious also in the thoracic radiography. And the curvature is centered at the level of T6 and T7 vertebrae. The vertebrae involved, if we look at the MRI, are not terribly misshapen. However, the intervertebral discs cranially and caudally to T7, are markedly wedge-shaped with the apex ventrally. And you can see how the nucleus pulposus, which here is white, is hyperintense in T2-weighted images, is kind of shifted dorsally, and you can compare it to a normal nucleus pulposus of other vertebrae. And again, this is a 6-month-old dog. Probably by growing, the T7 vertebra would acquire a more obviously wedge shape. And this deformity at the level of the vertebral end plates and intervertebral discs has resulted in the dorsal spinous processes being crowded, and there is a supraspinous ligament at this level, and as the kyphosis develops, the ligament pulls on the dorsal spinous processes, and this is a young animal, so there is quite a degree of bone plasticity. And basically, the dorsal spinous processes and the laminae are pulled backward, and this results in the stenosis of the vertebral canal that we can see here is reduced to 1/3 of its normal width, resulting in the severe spinal cord compression. So, what about treatment? Conservative treatment would involve physiotherapy to optimize the function of the surviving axons in the affected spinal cord segment, exercise restriction until the animal has reached full skeletal maturity, and in case of any signs of spinal pain, anti-inflammatory medications and analgesia such as gabapentin, which is quite efficacious medication to treat neuropathic pain. However, the bottom line, the fundamental defect here is anatomical, and therefore surgical treatment is the ideal course of action. Obviously, it's not without risk, is quite a big surgery, and there are different surgical techniques described. Here we have had excellent results with this technique, which is made possible by the close collaboration between the neurosurgeons and the soft tissue surgeon. And we approach the thoracic vertebra through the thorax. So here you can see the lungs, and these are the vertebral body, and through each vertebral body we have placed one screw. And you can see that simply by applying the costal retractor, the spine is less kyphotic, although we don't want to overcorrect it, we don't want to overstretch it, because that would put excessive pressure on the neurovascular structures and could have detrimental effects. And obviously we do all of this under fluoroscopic guidance. And here you can see the preoperative radiographs and the postoperative radiographs, lateral and dorsoventral view. I have to admit that positioning here is not perfect, and there is a mild degree of scoliosis. As I said earlier, we don't aim at realigning, making the spinal, the vertebral column straight, but by providing stability, we avoid that micromotion that results in recurrent spinal cord ischemia and neurological dysfunction. And again, here there is quite a level of plasticity because a young animal, so the vertebral canal can remodel to some degree. And here you see the chest drain that obviously following the thoracotomy the dog has to have for a few days postoperatively. We obviously provide very good analgesia. And as I said earlier, this is a complex surgery, but the results have been very rewarding. Here we have a video of our little pug just the day after surgery. Obviously, there is very good analgesia, but something that I have to say the owners have noticed very quickly is that, as you can see, the tail is curled up again. And there seems to be already a neurological benefit. He can move a couple of steps by himself, and again, the tail posture is closer to normal. And this is just 1 week post-op. As soon as the next video will appear, I will get it started. And here the chest drain has been removed, and the amount of analgesia required is limited, And that's quite remarkable. So our hypothesis is that there is a degree of vertebral instability and repeated microtrauma to the spinal cord and vascular injury, which explains the non-painful myelopathy, which can rapidly progress, and also the rapid postoperative recovery. And what's interesting is that in those cases, the owners are nearly as pleased with the tail posture than with the improvement in the neurological function of the pelvic limbs. And clearly, this puppy is having much more fun now than before the surgery. And 2 months later, we have one more video about this dog. He's back for a checkup and radiography prior to being reintroduced to normal exercise level. And you can see that he's much, much happier and he's no longer paretic and has just a mild degree of ataxia in his pelvic limbs. So this case in this pug, I've used it mainly to illustrate a case where the spinal anomaly had resulted in quite dramatic neurological signs secondary to the severe spinal cord compression. However, we need to be aware that dogs like pugs, French bulldogs, English bulldogs, so all these common and more popular screw-tailed brachiocephalic dogs have a high prevalence of vertebral malformation without any neurological signs. This nice retrospective observational study evaluated the type and the prevalence of thoracic vertebral malformation in 171 neurologically normal dogs and 10 neurologically abnormal dogs. The group of neurologically normal dogs consisted of 68 pugs, 62 French bulldogs, and 41 English bulldogs, and they all underwent CT for either investigation of BOAS or other non-neurologic disorders. The 10 neurologically abnormal dogs were 9 pugs and 1 French bulldog, and they all underwent MRI. More than 80% of the neurologically normal dogs were affected by at least one single malformation, and nearly 60% had multiple malformations. So the prevalence was very high of the malformations at one or multiple sites, and the malformations included hemivertebra, block vertebra, spina bifida, and transitional vertebra. And I've added this slide to be able to illustrate these to you. So here we can see an example of hemivertebra. This is a sagittal reconstructed CT image. And we can see that the vertebra is even more wedge-shaped than in the case of the pug I illustrated earlier, but is not resulting in spinal cord compression or anyways in significant spinal cord compression. And this was a neurologically normal pug. In this other sagittal reconstructed CT image, we can see an example of block vertebra, and which is characterized by failure of vertebral segmentation with absence of the intervertebral disc space. So this looks like a unique vertebral body, but actually these are two vertebral bodies that are fused to each other. And you can see here how the spinous processes are kind of to belong to two different vertebrae, but are fused here. And this severe spondylosis deformans suggest increased biomechanical load at the intervertebral disc cranial to the block vertebra. This CT image, this transverse CT image, shows an example of spina bifida, which is characterized by incomplete closure of the vertebral arches, resulting in a cleft through the dorsal spinous process. And finally, this three-dimensional reconstructed CT image shows a thoracolumbar transitional vertebra, and you can see that this vertebra has a rib on one side and sort of a vestigial transverse process, which is a feature of a lumbar vertebra, on the opposite side. So it is important to be aware that those vertebral anomalies can occur with no neurological signs and not be the cause of neurological signs. And if those are present, they may be due to other conditions. The next case for today is a 6-month-old male Schipperke, and he was presented for progressively worse gait abnormality. He had developed urinary and fecal incontinence, which were considered partial because he had some voluntary control of micturition and defecation, but not always, and it was more difficult for him to control the urge to defecate and urinate, or after urinating he would dribble urine. So here we can see his gait is obviously abnormal. You can see he has a wide base stance and he's abducting excessively both pelvic limbs. Here we see the wide base stance. The thoracic limb seem normal. He's clearly shifting towards the thoracic limb a significant proportion of his body weight. And he has, when walked in circle, you can see spontaneous knuckling in the pelvic limb pose and also a degree of paresis. The neurological examination showed absent poor placement response in the pelvic limbs and normal in the thoracic limbs. The flexor withdrawal reflex was normal. So in summary, the neurological examination findings included pelvic limb general proprioceptive ataxia, mild paraparesis, white base stance in the pelvic limbs, spontaneous knuckling in both pelvic limb pose. The postural reactions, as you have seen in the video, were absent in the pelvic limbs and normal in the thoracic limbs. And spinal reflexes were normal. He didn't seem to have any discomfort on palpation of the spine. So this case, in terms of neurological localization, is quite similar to the previous one. And yes, it is a thoracolumbar myelopathy. Differential diagnosis, again, obviously we're talking of developmental anomalies of the spine, and again you can try to pick one or more of the conditions that were listed in the initial slide on congenital spinal malformation classification. But in a dog of this age presenting to us with these neurological signs progressing over 2-3 months, myelitis would not be, you know, would be a myelitis, perhaps an immune-mediated one, or one caused by a not particularly aggressive infectious agent. Neurodegenerative diseases can give progressive signs also in young dogs and lead to non-painful myelopathies. And sometimes, unfortunately, neoplasia, such as malformation tumors or lymphoma, can occur in young dogs. Laboratory investigations were normal, and here we see the MRI of this lovely Schipperke. We see a sagittal and a transfer, T2-weighted MRI images, and we can see this well-marginated sort of tear-shaped hyperintensity, which in MRI language means white on T2-weighted images. And this is basically a fluid-filled space resulting in spinal cord compression at the level of T10 vertebra. And in the transverse view, you can see how severely the spinal cord, which is gray, is compressed by the fluid-filled arachnoid space. So based on the MRI features, the main differential diagnosis or the diagnosis was spinal arachnoid diverticulum, which is a focal fluid field dilation of the subarachnoid space, which can lead to a progressive compressive myelopathy. Treatment in this case, we elected to perform a dorsal laminectomy at T9 T10 and resect the spinal arachnoid diverticulum. So we basically removed the abnormal dura mater and arachnoid. And the dog made an uneventful recovery from anesthesia and surgery. And here we see him, we need the video, please. Thank you. At 8 weeks postoperatively. And as you can see, the gait has returned nearly normal. There is just a mild degree of ataxia. And he looks much happier. This dog, I had a 10-year follow-up because we did surgery more than 10 years ago, and he actually lived a very happy life. He didn't suffer any recurrence of the subarachnoid diverticulum. And this condition, unfortunately, has the potential of recurring even when surgery is done with the greatest care, as shown in the veterinary literature. He presented for a non-neurological disease again 10 years after this video was obtained. So again, spinal arachnoid diverticula are not as rare as we think, and again, unfortunately, in breeds like the pug, the French bulldog, we see them fairly frequently in association with other conditions. And I spent a few slides on this condition because the spinal arachnoid diverticulum can be congenital but can also be acquired. So you can see dogs that are 5, 6, even 8 or more years old that have this condition. And the arachnoid diverticula can be single or multiple, or maybe bilobed or multilobed, and can be located dorsally to the spinal cord, as in this case, or dorsolaterally, or even ventrally. Most commonly, they tend to be ventral in the cervical spinal cord, the lower cervical spinal cord, and dorsal in the cranial cervical spinal cord and in the thoracolumbar spine. Large breed dogs tend to have cervical subarachnoid diverticula, and small breed dogs tend to have thoracic spinal arachnoid diverticula. The clinical presentation is pretty much as in the Skipper Key case I've showed you. So there is progressively deteriorating general proprioceptive ataxia, followed by paresis and a degree, more or less pronounced degree, of urinary and fecal incontinence in dogs with subarachnoid diverticulum located dorsally to the spinal cord. They retain ambulatory status but develop ataxia, which is quite a peculiar finding, whereas with acute spinal cord injuries caused by intervertebral disc herniation or ischemic myelopathy, the dogs are plegic by the time they develop urinary and fecal incontinence. And this has all to do with the pathways regulating urinating and urination and defecation. Spinal pain is uncommon, and the diagnosis requires MRI or eventually CT myelography, although CT myelography would not detect a non-communicating SAD, so a spinal arachnoid diverticulum that is not communicating with the subarachnoid space would not be visible on CT myelography. CSF analysis is generally normal or may show mild neuronucleopleocytosis or elevated total protein when the cyst is not the result of a meningitis. It is very important to assess these patients thoroughly for concurrent spinal diseases, whether we suspect a congenital SAD or an acquired SAD. So all these conditions have to be considered and have been reported concurrently with SAD in dogs. Treatment obviously will be influenced by the fact of whether we feel the SAD is acquired or congenital. Generally speaking, Surgery is recommended for the congenital form and for certain type of acquired form, but should surgery not be an option either for financial reasons or other reasons, some dogs do benefit of anti-inflammatory treatment course or courses with prednisolone and physiotherapy. And this study, which was a retrospective multicenter study, reported the outcome following medical and or surgical treatment in 96 dogs with acquired or congenital spinal arachnoid diverticula. 50 dogs were included in the medical treatment group, and the medical treatment mainly consisted of prednisolone, and in a smaller number of dogs, physiotherapy, carprofen or gabapentin. And the group of dogs undergoing surgery was composed of 46 dogs, and the resection of the abnormal dura mater was the most common type of surgery. The median follow-up was 16 months in medically treated dogs and 23 months in the dogs who underwent surgery. The study found that the dogs undergoing surgery had a significantly better outcome than medically treated dogs. However, dogs that were younger at disease onset, and I would say therefore most likely had congenital spinal arachnoid diverticula, were more likely to undergo surgical treatment than those who were included in the medical treatment group. And here you can see more in detail of the 46 dogs that underwent surgery for spinal arachnoid diverticula. 82% improved at study end time, so quite a long follow-up of nearly 2 years, and a smaller proportion deteriorated or remained stable. In the medical treatment group, so 50 dogs, dogs that improved, stable, or deteriorated were nearly split in nearly equal thirds, although the proportion that deteriorated is a bit higher than those that were stable or improved. However, some of these dogs had concurrent spinal diseases that could have interfered either with the choice of medical versus surgical treatment or with the final outcome. And that's the reason why a very thorough assessment of these cases is important. In this study, over 21% of dogs had either a previous or a concurrent spinal disease in close proximity with the site of the SAD, and these were vertebral malformations in 11 dogs, intervertebral disc herniation in 9, meningomyelitis in 1 dog, and as I mentioned earlier, pugs and French bulldogs had the highest rates of previous or concurrent spinal disease, and SAD is a not uncommon condition in these dogs, as well as vertebral malformations. So these can be quite challenging cases to manage, and a deep understanding of this condition and a thorough assessment is essential for a positive outcome, and also to ensure that the pet owner has realistic expectations. So we have one more case. He's a 6 month old male bulldog, and he had a 9 day history of not being himself, overall unwillingness to eat from the bowl on the floor. He didn't want to lower his head, and the owner, who was very observant, detected some kind of subcutaneous mass in the interscapular region. So went to his primary vet, and there was pyrexia, so he prescribed amoxicillin and clavulasic acid and carprofen, and this resulted in a clinical improvement in the general demeanor. However, the owner started noticing an abnormality in the pelvic limb gait. So the case was referred to us, and on general physical examination, we found BOAS, We confirmed the presence of the subcutaneous mass in the interscapular region, and overall this dog appeared a bit too lethargic for a puppy of that age, and the temperature returned to normal probably thanks to the medical treatment prescribed by the primary vet. Neurologic examination essentially was similar to what you have seen in the videos of the previous two dogs. The main difference was that this time there was discomfort on palpation of the cranial thoracic spine. So when there is pain, we have to think of the origin of the pain. Could it be the meninges? Could it be the vertebrae? Could it be a spinal instability? And the neuroanatomic localization was to the thoracolumbar spine, as in the previous cases. This is a lateral thoracic radiograph, which I think the primary vet did to also to investigate for concurrent diseases. Obviously, cardiac disease is also a problem in this breed. And from the radiographs, we can see that there are multiple congenital vertebral abnormalities, including block vertebra, hemivertebra. I think we can probably see these better in the MRI. So I will move to the next image. So here we have a midline sagittal, T2 weighted image, a paramedian sagittal, and three transverse T2 weighted images at the level mainly of T4. So at the level of T4 vertebra, we can see this ovoid well marginated, and we can see it also on the transverse mass, just ventrally to the dorsal spinous process. And it is compressing dorsally the spinal cord quite substantially, which would explain the pelvic limb neurological deficits and possibly the spinal pain. On MRI, we also see block vertebrae from T6 to T10, so lack of segmentation of the vertebral body. On T2 weighted MRI images, the intervertebral disc appear as this bright white structures, and here we don't see them at all because they are not present, they didn't develop, and the vertebral body are more or less fused to each other. And I appreciate it's not terribly easy to see, but you can also see that there is spina bifida at the level of T4. So there is this thin line that shows that the two halves of the spinous process of T4 are not fused. And then it all started, with the owner notices this interscapular subcutaneous mass, and the fat in T2 weighted images is bright white. And here we can see these dark structures and also these other dark tubular structure. They may be connected, they may not be connected, but definitely in the parasagittal view, this rather large tubular structure seems to go all the way to the dorsal aspect of the spinous process. So whether there is a connection between these abnormality and the structure compressing the spinal cord, considering the presence of spina bifida, is definitely a consideration we have to make. And if you look at the vertebral body of T4, you can also see an example of butterfly vertebra. So the two halves of the vertebral body have not fully fused, and here you can see a cleft that is filled in with fat, with epidural fat. So quite complex anomaly and multiple vertebral anomalies in this dog, but definitely the cause of the neurological signs is related to this mass compressing the spinal cord. And whether this mass is associated or related to an anomaly or another condition remains to be seen. So we took a lumbar CSF sample, and the analysis revealed severe mixed pleocytosis and increased protein content. There was no growth on bacterial and fungal culture, and bacteria was both aerobic and anaerobic. So quite a puzzling case. The final diagnosis was spina bifida of T4, vertebra, and a dermal sinus tract. So the subcutaneous structure was the dermal sinus tract, and that was extending all the way to the meninges, essentially. Dermal sinus tracts result from incomplete separation of the neural tube from the skin ectoderm during embryonic development, causing tubular tracts or sometimes even sacs lined with hair follicles, sweat and sebaceous gland that typically extend from the dorsal midline to the underlying tissue. Based on how deep they extend into the underlying tissues, dermal sinus tracts have been classified into type 1, type 2, type 3 and type 4. So type 1 extends to the supraspinous ligament, type 2 to the muscles, the epaxial muscles, type 3 just to the subcutaneous tissue, and type 4 instead goes all the way down to the meninges, and actually it is contiguous with the meninges, and the round-shaped, oval-shaped, well-marginated mass that we saw earlier in the MRI of this dog was essentially sebaceous material, quite hardened sebaceous material, and there were even hair that had penetrated through the sinus, the dermal sinus tract, all the way down to the spinal cord and had caused the chemical meningitis that had resulted into the pyrexia and obviously the CSF abnormalities. And this is an intraoperative picture of this dog. I'd probably start from this one. After clipping, the opening of the spinal tract, the sinus tract was apparent. Before clipping, it wasn't. Here you can see this small, just a few millimeters indentation of the surface of the skin. And this is again the skin and the fat surrounding the tubular structure, which was the mass that the owner had palpated in the interscapular region, which due to the secretion had become inflamed and was painful. Sometimes there can be discharge from the opening in the skin of the sinus, other times there isn't. But as the secretions penetrate in the meningeal in the arachnoid space, then that can cause meningitis. And here is the part of the sinus, of the dermal sinus tract, that is contiguous with the meninges. This is the dura mater, and here we have done a dorsal laminectomy, so the spinous process and adjacent lamina has been removed. And the oval shaped structure that we saw on MRI was located here, so I had to incise the dura mater, remove the origin of the sinus tract, remove the mass that was compressing the spinal cord. And this dog, as well as any dogs with a dermal sinus tract that is fully excised, can have an excellent outcome. So I hope that this overview of spinal anomalies in dogs have been of interest and has also been food for thoughts. Anytime now you will see a young patient with spinal neurological signs. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for the webinar, Louisa. There aren't any questions at the moment, but if anyone does have any, they can email in. On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louisa for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.